From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today, Donald Trump detailed a long list of veterans groups which received money from his January fundraiser to reporters who said it was legitimate to ask where the almost $6 million had gone. He said he wanted to keep it private. You'll be hearing more about this story today.
We're also watching the fight for Fallujah in Iraq. It's on again. Fallujah is the city where American Marines engaged in some of the bloodiest battles of the Iraq War back in 2004. And now, 12 years later, Iraqi forces are fighting to retake it from ISIS, which took control of the city more than 2 years ago. The BBC's Ahmed Maher is Baghdad bureau chief for the BBC. He joins us today from London. And Ahmed, tell us more about this fight for Fallujah. What's happening today?
The Iraqi army, backed by thousands of Shia militias, are advancing towards the city center. That's the main challenge facing the government forces and the pro-government forces. So far, the indications coming from the government side, and of course we can't independently verify these accounts, that the battle or the operations are going as planned. But as I said, the main challenge is to dislodge the ISIS militants from the city center, who are believed to be entrenching their positions through tunnels in the city center. That's right. The main challenge.
Well, there are some aid groups who are saying that what's happening in Fallujah right now is an unfolding human catastrophe. We have some sound from some people who escaped from Fallujah before this battle began. They spoke to the BBC. Let's listen.
We were surrounded by Daesh for more than 2 years. We've survived on barley bread because there is no food.
Daesh's ways are no secret to anyone. They have spared no efforts to hurt people.
Ahmed, we're seeing reports that there are still some 50,000 civilians trapped inside Fallujah. Can you describe what the conditions are for them or how much danger they're in?
To explain it in plain terms and simple terms, the army has been laying siege to Fallujah for 6 months before the operation, before the start of the operation. And this is on the one hand. On the other hand, ISIS, or the Islamic State organization, denied the families and the civilians exit from the city. That's the main dilemma. So they were caught between a rock and a hard place, between a government siege and, of course, the government. When you talk to them, they categorically deny that they are using starvation as a weapon of war. But when we managed to talk to civilians who fled Fallujah, and also we verified videos of women from Fallujah saying that they surviving on rotten bread, saying that the government is using starvation as a weapon of war. This is what on the one hand. On the other hand, as we just heard, life under ISIS is a nightmare in the description of many civilians there. Many of them talked about the unyielding practices of ISIS. So the civilians are paying the price.
So, Ahmed, let me just jump in here because I want to be sure I understood correctly what you said, that not only are civilians having to suffer under the brutality of ISIS, but that the government itself is using starvation as a weapon of war, and you were able to verify that?
Basically, when you talk to the army, they deny that they are using starvation as a weapon of war. But when you talk to the civilians themselves who escaped Fallujah, they confirmed that the local markets ran out of food. They survived on rotten bread, a few dates, ISIS, getting their own supplies from their smuggling routes, basically to the west of Fallujah, where there are still bastions and strongholds for ISIS. So, this is a very terrible situation, basically, for the civilians.
Finally, Ahmed, for the Iraqi government, for the country, what would success or failure in Fallujah mean?
Well, the success would give the Iraqis a big boost to the major battle, which is the battle for Mosul, further north. And Mosul is Iraq's second largest city, and it is the de facto capital for ISIS in Iraq. But the failure, it would definitely mean catastrophe at the political and the military levels. At the military level, it would represent a major setback for the effort to dislodge the Islamic State from the country.
Hmm. Well, Ahmed Meher is the BBC's Baghdad correspondent. He's speaking to us today from London. Ahmed, many thanks.
Thanks.
By now, you've probably seen the cell phone video. We're not going to play it now because even the sound is traumatic. On Saturday, a 4-year-old boy got into the gorilla enclosure at the Cincinnati Zoo. The endangered 450-pound silverback gorilla Harambe at first stands near the boy, looks like he might even be protecting him. Onlookers shout in fear. The mother yells, "Mommy's right here. Mommy loves you." It is horrifying. More so when the 17-year-old gorilla then repeatedly grabs the boy by the leg, dragging him through the several inches of water at sudden and breathtaking speed. What happens next has not been shown, thankfully. Zookeepers, fearing for the boy's life, shoot Harambe to death. The boy, again thankfully, only suffered minor injuries. But animal rights groups and some experts are outraged. They say there should have been another way without killing a glorious endangered animal. Here now is animal expert Vicky Croak, whose first book, The Modern Ark, was about zoos and issues around keeping animals in captivity, is here. Vicky, unbearable video. But are we imposing our own wishes on this animal that he might have been protecting this child? What do we know about gorillas and how they might respond to a small being in their midst?
Hey, Robin, like you, I'm heartsick over this story. Horrible to see this beautiful, beautiful, intelligent animal and know that he's dead today.
And this frightened child. It's horrible. So,
yes.
Yeah.
So what we know is that apes, gorillas, are our fellow primates, and we actually are pretty good at reading their body language. And in several parts of that video, as people have said, experts and non-experts alike, it looks as though he's protecting the little boy. There are also moments where he is a 450-pound male gorilla. We know that chimpanzees, a 75-pound chimpanzee is 3 times stronger than a human man. Mm. So you can imagine the power of this gorilla. He pulls the boy, and in those few moments, the poor people at the zoo who love Harambe most have to make an agonizing decision.
Right. Well, but people might be remembering in 1996 when a 3-year-old fell into an enclosure at a zoo in Chicago, and the female gorilla at that point retrieved the child, even placed the child near a door where zookeepers could
That's right. It's a beautiful video and a beautiful moment. And Binti, this female, is very maternal toward the boy who fell in. And she guards him and she brings him to a door. And we've seen videos of that. We've seen videos from 1986. There was a similar incident at the Jersey Zoo in the UK. That time it was a male gorilla. And again, a little boy who landed in the enclosure. And Jumbo, the male gorilla, you may remember seeing Knuckle. He knuckled patted the back of the boy. Turned out well. In Boston in 2003, little Joe, a male gorilla, escaped the zoo, bit a little girl, left not only his enclosure but the zoo, and was outside. Little Joe, by the way, is alive and well. He's about 23 years old now.
So people who hear these stories and they say, look, it's a primate. He might have continued to protect the child. Answer that question. Was there any other way?
This is the excruciating part, and I spoke with lots of people in the zoo world, as you can imagine, including Tony Vecchio, who I've depended on his judgment for many years, and he's at the Jacksonville Zoo and Garden in Florida. One of the things he said is you drill and drill and drill, and what you know is when the emergency happens, it's going to be outside of anything you've drilled for.
Right.
So yes, here are the things that could have been done. You know that the zoo people considered them. One, tranquilizer. Can you shoot the animal with a tranquilizer? Well,
It takes too long.
10 to 15 minutes, at best 8 minutes. So that's out. Another thing that's been suggested by people like Ian Redman, who once worked with Diane Fossey and is now the head of Ape Alliance, you can get lots of zoo animals to trade one thing for another. They do this for medical care. So if something drops into the exhibit, they may trade it for a grape. Mm. That's something that obviously in an excited moment like this, as we were saying, we can read primate body language. They can read ours. You heard on that video the excitement of the crowd, the panic that had to have affected Harambe.
Right. It feels like there are people who want to lay blame. There are petitions going around that, to arrest the parents or examine how they raise children. But, you know, and you can tell people now, gee, if anything happens at a zoo, be quiet so you don't upset the gorilla. But in the moment, so it sounds like the one thing, though, that maybe zoos might be reacting to is, how do you make those enclosures so nobody can get in?
That's right. In general, zoo exhibits are designed to keep animals in and not to keep people out. There are barriers, and the barriers at the zoo met all the protocols that are required. But I think it's time to question, what do we require? It will be a sad day, as Tony Vecchio said to me, if we have to build huge barriers to keep people out. But look, a four-year-old boy, we're not talking about a cat burglar who planned this for a week. A little boy slipped right in there. I think we count on people taking care and
preventing that.
We can't count on that.
Yeah, yeah. Vicky Croak reports on all things animal for Here and Now on this heartbreaking story of Harambe.
Tomorrow, Princeton University Press will reissue the Kerner Report. The controversial 1968 document was assembled by the National Advisory Committee on Civil Disorders after a series of riots in American cities in the mid-1960s. It offered a window into the roots of racism and inequality in the United States. One of its findings was particularly stark. Quote, "Our nation is moving towards two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal." Now, 48 years later, Lester Graham from Here and Now contributor Michigan Radio has this report on why the Kerner Commission's recommendations were ignored and why in an age of Black Lives Matter activism, the report's lessons still resonate today. And a warning that his story contains language that some listeners may find objectionable.
It was called the Long Hot Summer. 1967 saw dozens of racial uprisings in cities such as Newark, Boston, and Detroit. And Detroit's was the worst. 43 people were killed and more than 1,000 injured, most of them black. Thousands of National Guard troops and police were already in the streets. The mayor and the governor wanted more help. President Lyndon Johnson sent in 5,000 U.S. Army troops.
I take this action with the greatest regret and only because of the clear, the unmistakable, and the undisputed evidence that Governor Romney of Michigan and the local officials in Detroit have been unable to bring the situation under control.
Before the fires in Detroit were out, Johnson spoke to the nation again. He was appointing an 11-member advisory commission on civil disorders. It was chaired by then-Illinois Governor Otto Kerner and became known as the Kerner Commission.
The commission will investigate the origins of the recent disorders in our cities. It will make recommendations to me, to the Congress, to the state governors, and to the mayors for measures to prevent or contain such disasters in the future.
The president wanted to know why. Why did these uprisings happen? Within 7 months, the Kerner Commission had an answer. Nathaniel R. Jones was assistant general counsel for the commission.
One of the conclusions of the Kerner report was that white racism was the cause of the upsets and the uprisings that we had. In fact, the report stated that white society created it, perpetuates it, and sustains it.
In other words, white racism, white attitudes were the underlying reasons for racial unrest in the cities. Many white politicians and news media vehemently resisted that finding. Detroit had been seen by the nation as a model of race relations. Blacks were getting jobs in Detroit that simply were not available to people of color in much of the rest of the country. Overlooked was the fact that Detroit African Americans often were given the hardest and dirtiest jobs, often were passed up for promotions, and generally made less money. Housing was inferior. Unemployment among people of color was higher. Relationships with police were strained.
The commission said in its report that there was a combination of complex social, psychological, poverty problems all tangled up, which create this feeling on the part of people that they can't trust authority. And that was true as a lead into what happened in the 60s, and it's true now.
The report's most quoted conclusion read, "Our nation is moving toward two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal." Joe T. Darden is a professor at Michigan State University and co-author of a book on the 1967 Detroit riots. He says the Kerner Report challenged whites' attitudes about blacks, and he says that made President Johnson worry it would damage the Democrats' chance to keep the White House. So, publicly, Johnson barely acknowledged the report.
The report put the responsibility for all of this stuff on white society and white institutions. That, I think, was a surprise to some white Americans, and I think that that was part of the reason he was very careful not to upset the large segment of white society. That was why I think it happened like that.
Another factor in President Johnson's silence on the Kerner Report was his own ego. He felt the report ignored the accomplishments of his Great Society programs. But in a 1969 interview for the LBJ Library, Commission Chair Otto Kerner said praising Johnson's work would give the report a political flavor the commission members did not want. Kerner said Johnson privately told him he was working quietly to implement Kerner Report recommendations.
He says, you know, we've been trying to do these things that you've recommended in the report. And as you know, Congress is not very acceptable to the things that I proposed. But he said, I want you to know that I have the members of the cabinet, the White House staff people are still trying to have accepted those things I've already recommended.
But that's not what Johnson told one of his political buddies. A phone call between Johnson and Chicago Mayor Richard J. Daley reveals Johnson had problems with the report. By then, Johnson had announced he would not seek another term as president, but his former attorney general, Robert F. Kennedy, was running, and Kennedy pushed the Kerner Report recommendations. Johnson also felt the commission's vice chair, New York Mayor John Lindsay, had pushed the commission too far.
And Bobby just gave me hell today for not carrying out the Kerner Commission study. Well, I didn't realize when I appointed Kerner that this son of a bitch from New York, Lindsay, would take charge. He did take charge, and he recommended I hire 2.5 million people on federal payroll. And I just, I've not wanted to reflect on Kerner and criticize the commission. At the same time, I couldn't embrace it because I've got a budget.
That Johnson budget had doubled because of the Vietnam War. Nearly five decades later, that report by the Kerner Commission is still considered one of the most insightful documents on race relations and remedies for discrimination to ever be published by the government. Michigan State University professor Joe T. Darden says the cost of ignoring the Kerner Report set opportunities for African Americans back decades.
That would have eliminated this separation where you have central city, suburb, white suburb, black central city, white affluent, black poverty. That would have prevented that. They didn't take that alternative. What the Kerner Commission really wanted society to do.
Some scholars argue that Americans, white Americans, have not learned the lesson of the 1960s uprisings or the recommendations to correct the problems.
In the wake of the Kerner Report, we have created two societies that are deeply unequal. That is a fact.
Heather Ann Thompson is a professor at the University of Michigan and wrote the book, Who's Detroit?
The inequality, income inequality, racial inequality, suburban city inequality, job inequality, we could just go on and on and on, is far worse. And that is a deeply racialized inequality. So we've done that. The question remains, what do we do next?
Resentment surrounding issues of race has been building over those decades. Resentment among blacks who still find themselves at the bottom of the economic ladder, and resentment among whites who've been knocked down a rung or two. Paul Lee is a Detroit historian who's written on the 1967 uprising in Detroit. He says things are not any better today than they were in the 1960s, and perhaps worse. He says the protests we've seen in the last couple of years are revealing.
Our situation, that is the situation of African Americans in Detroit and throughout the country, I think is much more precarious than it's been perhaps in a century.
The reason, says Lee, is the shaky economic underpinnings of black neighborhoods. Few blacks own their own homes, a significant factor in building wealth. The relatively few middle-class black families who could afford it later followed white families to the suburbs. With them went black businesses. The little economic power African Americans had slipped away. But there was optimism, because in some cities, political power grew for black Americans. Black mayors and city council members were elected. But Paul Lee says political power is limited.
While I think that black political power is important, I think that if there's no economic foundation, then black power is relatively meaningless. Black political power is relatively meaningless.
The shift from black power in the 1960s to today's Black Lives Matter seems to be slipping from a demand to have a seat at the table to the request, please don't kill us. But Black Lives Matter isn't the only protest movement. In Detroit, dating back to at least the takeover by an emergency manager and then bankruptcy, new groups have been raising their voices in and around the city. There are protests for economic inclusion, against foreclosures and water shutoffs, and against police brutality.
No racist police! No racist police!
We're skeptical of government because government isn't serving us.
Reverend Charles Williams II is the president of the Michigan chapter of National Action Network. He says people are frustrated that in many ways life in Detroit is worse now than it was in 1967.
As we see our struggle today, we see that some of those same issues are ahead of us. And so this is the reason why we must continue to organize, and it's the reason why we continue to organize.
Heather Ann Thompson, the University of Michigan professor, says policymakers today largely are ignoring issues in the same way policymakers ignored them in the 1960s.
The good news is that we now, I think, are really hearing from those people who have suffered this very directly. And that's why Ferguson has blown up. And that's why Baltimore has exploded. And that's why people across cities in America or cities across America are speaking out and saying, no, we need a different civil rights movement, right? We need a different moment of change.
And to be effective, that change will have to negotiate opportunities for African Americans to be included in both political and economic power, just as the Kerner Report recommended nearly five decades ago. For Here and Now, I'm Lester Graham.
And we had assistance on this, reporting assistance from Bill McGraw with Bridge Magazine, and production assistance on this story from the Oral History Project at the Lyndon Baines Johnson Presidential Library in Austin, Texas.
The French Open is in its second week, and an American woman is on the radar, Charleston, South Carolina's Shelby Rogers. The 23-year-old, ranked 108th in the world, made it to the semifinals. Here she is during a post-match interview.
I always dreamed it would happen, but I'm not sure I thought it could.
You wanted a tissue?
Yes, she wanted a tissue. So maybe to James Beck. He's tennis columnist for the Post and Courier in Charleston. James, you know Shelby. You go to church with her. How exciting is this?
It's really exciting here. Everybody's calling me and everybody's reading about Shelby. Yes, I go back a long ways with Shelby from when she was a young girl looking at her sister play.
Yeah. So I'm imagining you spilled a few tears when you watched her as well. She was an 8-year-old ball girl at the Family Circle Cup.
Family Circle, yes.
Yep. And the way she's winning, four straight upsets. Your thoughts as you watched her?
Well, Shelby is really playing the best tennis I've ever seen her play right now, of course. And I noticed the last time when she played at the Family Circle a couple of months ago, and she lost her first round match, but it was three sets. And I thought then that's the best I've ever seen Shelby play. And I knew that if she continued to play that way, she could beat almost anyone in the world. She's picked her game up to such a level and playing at such a level of consistency and playing textbook tennis. She's hitting corner to corner, and she's able to hit the open spaces. And not many players can do that as well as Shelby is right now, other than just, of course, Serena and Venus and players like that.
Yeah.
But I really think Shelby has an opportunity to probably... She has a chance to win this next match, at least, I'm sure.
Yep. So you're hearing other people call. What are they saying?
People in Charleston are just so excited. We've never had a player of this caliber, a player who could go out and beat the best in the world. I've been doing tennis for the Post and Courier for about 40 years. I've covered the original Billie Jean King, Bobby Rigg Battle of the Sexes in Houston in 1973. And we've never had a player that's ever won a match in a Grand Slam tournament before Shelby came along.
Yeah. It has already been life-changing. We understand so far at the French Open, she's won about $330,000, which is almost half of her entire career earnings. You know, it feels like no matter what happens, a lot's going to change after this.
Yes, I think it will. Of course, she will have to repeat it this next year to keep her ranking up. But if she wins this next match, she will win more than $500,000, actually $561,000. And her ranking will go up into the top 40 in the world.
Wow. I mean,
from where she started out when she arrived in Paris at 108.
Yeah. Well, are you already thinking of a homecoming? No matter what happens?
People probably here will give her a homecoming. Family circle, I'm sure they'll do something over there. Even though she has trained at other places in Charleston with Brian Minton, was her coach. She moved away to work with the USTA in Boca Raton a few years ago. But her family still lives on Daniel Island, and they're over in Paris at this time watching her.
Well, as all of Charleston is watching from home, James Beck, tennis columnist for the Post and Courier there in Charleston, South Carolina, thank you so much for talking about your hometown star, and best of luck.
Thank you very much for talking to me. I appreciate this. And Shelby does too, I'm sure.
Here's how serious water concerns in the West are right now. The water level at Lake Mead, outside of Las Vegas, is the lowest it's ever been. Lake Mead is the largest reservoir in the country, and it provides water to Arizona, California, Nevada, and Mexico, too. And right now, it's only about one-third full. And if the water level doesn't rise above a certain threshold by the end of the year, that would trigger a water shortage declaration with some major consequences. Dave White is a professor at the School of Community Resources and Development at Arizona State. He's also director of the university's Decision Center for a Desert City, and he joins us from Phoenix. Dave, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Meghna.
First of all, I wonder if you could just describe how significant a water source Lake Mead is for the region.
Lake Mead, together with Lake Powell, the two major storage reservoirs on the Colorado River system, are absolutely essential to the social, economic, and environmental vitality of the entire western United States. Together, the reservoirs and the Colorado River system provide at least part of the drinking water supply to nearly 40 million people in the western United States, produce millions of megawatt hours of energy production, provide habitat for threatened and endangered species, and produce a tremendous agricultural crop, particularly during the winter months.
Mm. So another way of putting it is that life as we know it in much of the western United States wouldn't be possible without Lake Mead, the Hoover Dam, and Lake Powell.
Exactly. Yeah, these resources have been critical to the development of the Western United States, and they really are very significant, both engineering as well as political achievements that have supported the economic growth in the region over the last several decades.
Mm. So let's talk about why the lake is so low right now. What are the major factors contributing to this?
Yes, the lake is approximately 37% of its capacity right now, and the major contributing factors include a significant drought that has lasted more than a decade and a half in the western United States. Your listeners may be aware of the very acute and severe drought that California has faced over the last 4 years. Well, the region at large has been in and out of drought conditions for about the last 16 years, and so the levels of the reservoirs have been declining over that time. The levels have been declining also because of the increased demand and the deficit between our annual demands and our available supplies. And finally, we have the signal of climate change, mm-hmm. which is causing increased temperature and decreased surface water supplies into the system. So these three factors are the explanation for the reason for the low lake levels at this time.
So given the three factors that you just mentioned, it seems as if some long-term decisions have to be made regarding how the water from Lake Mead is managed. I mean, I want to talk about that in a second, but let's focus on the short term. Will there need to be water restrictions put in place, given the fact that it's only a third full?
Well, there are a couple of possibilities. One is that the federal government, through the Secretary of the Interior, would declare an official shortage on the Colorado River system. If that were to occur, that would initiate rules that were agreed to by the states that share in the apportionment of that water. Those rules would require curtailment of the supplies or deliveries of the water, particularly to the lower basin states, Arizona, most notably. So we could see restrictions in the deliveries of water as early as January of 2017, although that is looking less likely. We are almost certain to see those restrictions unless major interventions are achieved by January of 2018.
Have such restrictions ever been put in place before?
No, we've not reduced the deliveries of Colorado River water to the states since the creation of the reservoirs and since the deliveries of those reservoirs. The states, in the midst of the last major period of drought in the early 2000s, agreed to a set of guidelines which specify what would be the restrictions to the states in the event that the reservoir levels drop below a critical threshold on January 1st.
Okay. Well, let's say that that does happen. I mean, we don't know yet for sure, but if it did and the restrictions were put into place about the amount of water that could come out of Lake Mead, what would that look like? What effect would that have on the states that rely on the water?
The principal effect for Arizona would be a reduction in deliveries of water from the Colorado River system through what's called the Central Arizona Project Canal. The CAP Canal delivers the water from the river across the desert through to the major urban areas of Phoenix and down to Tucson. In the event of a shortage declaration, the first cut would be to what are known as excess water rights, which would affect mostly Arizona's central Arizona agriculture, as well as some American Indian water rights. And so those first cuts are actually already planned for and would have very little to no effect on the municipal users in the state.
And in the longer term, would municipal users begin to feel an effect?
In the longer term, they would if the lake levels continue to drop. There are different critical thresholds in terms of elevation above sea level that are identified, starting with 1,075 feet. But as those lake levels continue to drop, the cuts to the state in Arizona would affect not only the agricultural users, but eventually municipal and industrial users. Mm. Now, fortunately, the states are not waiting around for a declaration to occur. The leaders of the states of Arizona, Nevada, and California are involved in deliberations right now and discussions to enact voluntary curtailments in advance of any federal government declaration to ensure that we conserve water in the lower basin and maintain those lake levels above the critical thresholds. And so it's this voluntary leadership, and the states deserve credit for engaging in these dialogues ahead of the crisis point.
Right. You actually anticipated what was going to be my next question, because I was going to ask you if the states are showing the ability to work together on this water management issue, because water can be such a contentious issue, not just between the federal government and individual states, but between states themselves and, of course, states and landowners, farmers, cities, towns. It's never straightforward in terms of how to bring all the stakeholders together.
Right. It's a very complex suite of players and stakeholders, as you mentioned. We have seen an uptick in the last several years in the voluntary and collaborative approaches that involve the water institutions. So the current discussions among the states is one example. Another example is something called the Colorado River System Conservation Pilot Program, which is led by the Bureau of Reclamation and includes funding from some of the major players, including Denver Water, the Central Arizona Project, the Metropolitan Water District in Los Angeles, the Southern Nevada Water Authority, which manages Las Vegas supplies. And these agencies have together pooled their resources to be able to fund projects that engage in conservation and then retain the conserved water into the reservoirs. So this is an example of another collaborative and institutional approach. We've been focused predominantly in the last 100 years on engineering approaches to water resources management. And clearly the next generation of solutions are related to the way that we manage demand and the way that we manage our institutions.
Mm. Well, finally, Professor White, I'm thinking back to the group of challenges or reasons why you said that the level at Lake Mead is as low as it is. And of course, the one that's of longest term concern is climate change. And given the fact that it doesn't seem as if any trend regarding a warming planet is going to change anytime soon, what's your long-term prognosis for the overall water level in Lake Mead?
Well, climate change presents a significant challenge to the long-term water sustainability in our region. Fortunately, we have a variety of strategies that allow us to adapt to that changing climate. These include managing demand through smart conservation-based incentives, technology, and pricing, expanding reuse and recycling of reclaimed water, examining the possibilities of desalination, fostering more innovative and adaptive water institutions, and focusing our water decision-making on maximizing the economic and quality of life benefits of every gallon of water invested. So it will take all of these solutions in concert to be able to sustain the vitality of the region in the face of not only our existing short-term challenges, but the long-term challenges associated with the impacts of global climate change.
Well, Dave White is a professor at the School of Community Resources and Development at Arizona State University. He's also director of the university's Decision Center for a Desert City. Dave White, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Magna. It was a pleasure.
Housing prices are going up fast in America's biggest cities. The Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller Home Price Index rose 5.4% in March compared with a year ago. Pushing up those prices, solid job growth, better wages in some quarters, and low mortgage rates, all good news for sellers, especially in western cities like Denver, Seattle, and Portland, where prices grew by double digits. Some of those same economic factors also led to the biggest surge in consumer spending in nearly 7 years. Today, the Commerce Department said that overall spending was up 1% last month. That's the fastest jump in nearly 7 years, as Americans bought more big-ticket items like new cars. Economists say it's a sign the economy is on solid ground after a sluggish start to the year. But as we know, that's not being felt everywhere. And here comes a pivot. The job picture is not as bright for Philadelphia police. Staffing in the country's fourth largest police department has hit a 22-year low, and the department is desperately looking for recruits. So it recently loosened hiring requirements in hopes of filling that gap, a move that has critics, but supporters say will actually open the door to many more qualified candidates. Bobby Allen of Here and Now contributor WHYY reports.
At a packed job fair at Temple University, Philadelphia Police Officer Samuel Cruz says word has gotten around.
The biggest question today was, when are you guys getting rid of the college credits?
Right now, having 2 years of college is a police department mandate. But Police Commissioner Richard Ross recently told City Council that nixing that requirement might just boost applications. So starting in July, the college requirement is going away. Ross says the department's 400 unfilled positions might be driven by other factors, but it's likely that completing 2 years of college is a hurdle for some.
Look, I have my reservations about going backwards on an educational requirement, I'll be honest with you. But my first concern is the safety of the people who live and visit and work in the city.
And until the department can reach its full staffing level of 6,500 officers, more and more districts will be looking for ways to make up for the manpower shortage.
Police working a lot more overtime and being tired. When officers are tired, it sounds like common sense, right? They have a harder time doing their jobs. We all are stressed out. We all make more mistakes when we've been working too long.
Emily Owens is a criminology professor at the University of Pennsylvania. She says it's especially hard to maintain stable staff levels in such a big department. Most cities have 2 officers per 1,000. Philly has 4. Still, she says lowering standards could be risky and thinks a better incentive is offering more money. Right now, a starting cop in Philadelphia makes about $48,000 a year.
I would say that would be a good way to get more people from all neighborhoods and from all backgrounds to apply for your jobs.
About a third of all big city police departments require at least 2 years of college. And there's debate about whether college credits really make better cops. Critics say you don't learn street smarts by sitting in a seminar. But the other side argues that more critical thinking skills can only help police. That's been the position of Pierce College in Philadelphia. The requirement change could hurt the school's 2-year degree enrollment. Either way, Legal Studies faculty chair Ed Miller says having fewer college-educated cops is bad for the communities they serve.
The lifelong learning skills and the community awareness that comes through your experience in college, I think that brings a stronger candidate to the process.
Back at the recruitment table at the college fair, Officer Cruz tells Tomas McWaters about another hiring change soon to take effect.
And you're not 19 yet, or you're 19, right?
Yes, I'll be 20
in a few
months.
Right now, if you want to apply, I would take advantage of it because come in July, you have to be 22 to join the department.
Okay. Police officials think raising the age bar from 19 to 22 will bring in more mature applicants, college credits or not. After the chat, McWaters told me no matter what age, most of his friends in West Philly would never think of becoming a cop.
Because people would look at you like you're a rat or something. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's just how the neighborhood is. I can't change it within a day.
But McWater says he's willing to put aside the neighborhood's attitude and prove to them that the police officers you want in your community are the people from your community. It's a message the department has been pushing, too. But as UPenn's Owen says, the viral social media accounts of police shootings of unarmed black men have really impacted perceptions.
A small number of bad officers having bad days that are caught on tape are viewed much more widely than they were 3 years ago. Right, and that gives all officers sort of a bad rap.
Antonio James of North Philly, who's considering becoming a police officer, says that's definitely true in his community.
Yeah, I know some of my friends don't want to become a cop because of what they say about us, or it's not cool to be a cop because of what they do. I see different black American people getting frisked every day and being treated like they're nothing.
But James, just like McWaters, thinks the best way to change that is from within. If the department can convince many others to think the same way, it might get closer to filling its officer shortfall. For Here and Now, I'm Bobby Allen in Philadelphia.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.